But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show, where we discuss the themes shaping portfolios and the wealth management industry more widely. My guest this week is John Lee, or to give him his proper title, Lord Lee of Trafford. Lord Lee is an active parliamentarian and private investor, and famously became the UK's first ISA millionaire back in 2003. As such, I'm hoping he'll be able to help dissect a topic that's back in the headlines: why don't more British people invest? John, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here.
So I appreciate this is somewhat well-trodden territory, but a place I wanted to start is I wanted to take you back a couple of decades to when you first revealed you'd accumulated £1 million in your ISA. Were people surprised?
I think people were surprised. When PEPs, as the precursor to ISAs, were first introduced, I think in about 1987 by Nigel Lawson, I recognized fairly quickly that this was a great opportunity, a sort of tax-free opportunity, a tax-free wrapper.
Yeah.
And so at that stage, I think you could only put in about £3,000 a year. So I put in the maximum amount for in those early years. And I remember the first share that I bought was a company called PIFCO, which is a Manchester-based manufacturer and wholesaler of electrical goods.
Okay.
And subsequently, they acquired Russell Hobbs.
And you hail from Manchester area yourself.
So I knew PIFCO. And so PIFCO was my first investment and ultimately was taken over by Salton, I think, of the USA. I put the max amount in. I reinvested the dividends, which of course compounded. PIFCO was paying a nice dividend, yielding about 6% when I bought it. Ticked all my boxes, over the years, as I say, I put the max amount in those 15 years between 87 and 2003, I obviously made mistakes, but overall, I think we got more things right than wrong and reinvested dividends, and there were some takeovers. And so I think from memory, I'd put in by 2003 about 126,000 in total over the years, and the portfolio was worth about £1 million. I had to weigh up. Do I disclose that, as it were? It's very difficult when one talks about personal wealth.
Yes.
I'm reluctant to do that today, but I decided at that stage it was significant, and obviously I was quite proud of having done that.
Yes.
And we published the full portfolio, and I think people were interested. Just looking back, I think where I was fortunate was that I was able to put in the maximum.
Yes.
But of course, it was only £3,000 initially, and then it rose very, very slightly. I think a lot of wealthy people didn't bother with PEPs in those days because the amounts, they said, oh, well, £3,000 neither here nor there, as it were. But the difference is that I did it year on year and then compounded the dividends, and gradually it built up. And really, I've continued post 2003, and thankfully, overall ISA now, of course, has grown significantly. I probably describe myself now as a professional ISA investor.
Okay.
And my ISA is worth about three times my non-ISA.
Yeah.
And that's my main focus, for obvious reasons.
Okay. Well, definitely speak to the power of, tax relief, or being able to invest tax-free there. So I suppose, coming back to our topic today, as an active private investor, you are the exception, not the rule, in the UK. Unsurprisingly, the wealth management industry says everyone should invest more. But now the Labour government is conspicuously engaged on this topic too. Why do you think this topic is getting all this attention now?
Well, I think it's fairly obvious. First of all, there's been near zero teaching of finance or anything about money in schools.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a national failure. So many youngsters leave school not knowing really hardly knowing what a bank is, certainly not knowing what a mortgage is.
Or what a pension is.
Or a pension is, and certainly not knowing what a share is. In those early years, an opportunity, you know, has been missed. And of course, we've ended up in a situation now, and all governments of all persuasions should be embarrassed by this, that now more young people speculate in cryptocurrency, not invest.
Yes.
I get very cross when people talk about investing in cryptocurrency.
Okay.
Far more young people speculate in cryptocurrency than invest in any traditional way.
Yes.
And so we should all be concerned about that. And I had the idea, supported by a number of Tory peers two or three years ago, using the NatWest shares that the government had to actually really transform the school scene from an investment point of view. And my idea was that, because the government, of course, had this large block of NatWest shares and
yeah.
bailed out NatWest, my idea was that they should donate to all state secondary schools, those who wanted, not compulsory, £5,000 worth of NatWest shares to be held for the long term that the school couldn't sell. And that £5,000 would have delivered a dividend of about £350 a year.
Okay.
And my idea was that the youngsters themselves should be allowed to decide how they spend that £350, whether it's something for the school, to subsidise a school trip, support a local charity, or buy more shares in NatWest or whatever.
So that people would become engaged with the idea
so
of
for
an
the
investment,
first time,
a return,
you're
and
absolutely
then what
right.
do you do with the money?
For the first time, young people, through this suggestion, if it had been picked up, would have had an idea of what a bank is, what a share is, or what a dividend is. I think it would have been transformative in a very different way. And Jeremy Hunter's chancellor was really taken with it and asked officials to look at it and asked me to talk to education ministers, and they were quite happy. I don't think the Treasury were too keen, of course. I mean, they're not famed for liking creative and original ideas.
Right.
Of course, they probably didn't want to give up £20 million, which really would have been a drop in the ocean, but it would have been transformative. I think had the government gone down the Tel-Sid route, selling those NatWest shares to the public, then I think there would have been a real chance that the government might have embraced that idea. But in the end, of course, they sold their NatWest shares in the market. And then we had the general election and a change of government.
Yes.
And although I tried to get the idea through to Rachel Reeves, I'm not sure it ever really landed on her desk.
Okay.
So that would have, I think, made a big difference. But the things are slowly improving. I think there is now rather more teaching of finance in schools. Still nothing like the level that it should be. And there are a number of bodies around now who are trying to encourage young people to invest and educate them in the financial world.
Yes. Just out of interest, would you teach finance in schools as part of maths, as part of a sort of PSHE or something?
It really wouldn't. As long as it's taught.
Yes.
As long as it's taught. And there are one or two schools where there is a master who's keen on the stock market and keen on, and so I think they go out of their way to create a little investment club. There are a few schools
right.
that are, you know, being sensible. And of course, the government now realizes that far more people should be encouraged to invest in UK companies. You know, there's a big campaign, I think, coming up in April.
Yes.
That the government's involved in and
backed by banks and investment
stock exchange. And all this will be, you know, will certainly be helpful. But we've still got a situation where, you know, the number of private investors, you know, has gradually reduced. Far fewer as a percentage of people in this country invest in the stock market as compared with our competitors, certainly as compared with the USA.
Yes.
There's a huge amount of money just sitting in the bank, in the banks, that really should be invested and could do a lot better for people. But I found so many people, when I talk to them, and you know, I do my best to encourage individuals. I like to see myself as a sort of evangelist for private investment.
Yes.
They don't really know quite where to start. They'd like to, but they're not quite sure. And of course, the other big failure in the country, in my judgment, has been over the years, the total failure of television
okay.
to cover the stock market and UK companies.
And you don't just mean a bit at the end of the
news
on
shares. I mean, sure, there's an occasional mention, you know.
The FTSE's down today.
Well, yeah. They'll talk about the FTSE possibly, or announce that Rolls-Royce has maybe won a major order or that Tesco has made X billion pounds, but that's about it.
Yes.
But there are no programs geared to the stock market that are educational.
We have a lot of Martin Lewis talking about the best savings rate.
Correct.
But that's not what
correct,
you're talking
but no,
about.
Because Martin Lewis is very focused on what is best for the consumer.
Okay.
You know, swap changing from one
yes.
utility supplier to the other, as it were. But he's talking about a different thing.
Okay.
I'm talking about traditional investment and some of the great UK companies that would be exciting from a television point of view and also attractive from an investment point of view. But the problem has been that an excessive regulation has meant that TV companies and producers are scared stiff of getting involved in this area. And therefore, it's just too complicated. And you know, there's a feeling that if they mention a particular company, you know, there's a big rush to buy shares and it would skew the market. And in the end, nothing's done. And so it's been a huge lost opportunity, and that's where I think we've gone wrong. And you see, the public is interested in business. I mean, look at Dragon's Den, for
yes.
example. You know, the popularity of that. And so, you know, I could have devised, you could have devised a whole range of programs that are focused on investment in the stock market that would be appealing as programs. Anyway, it's a huge lost opportunity. And of course, the young people now, aren't watching television. It's more social media and similar. But nevertheless, it's the adults still who probably got the majority of capital available for investment, and they're let down by the failure of television companies to cover.
Okay, I want to ask you about a couple of things that the government is trying to do about this. One is we've seen a tweak to ISA allowances, in particular. Working age people will be able to put less
sure.
money in a cash ISA. But my sense is you think ISAs aren't really the problem. In fact, you think it's quite a generous regime. Is that fair?
Yes, it is. I mean, I think to enable a husband and wife to each put in £20,000 into a tax-free,
yes.
tax-sheltered wrapper.
That's a lot of disposable income every year, isn't it?
Is very generous, actually, you know, given the overall financial situation of the country. And, of course, you know, it's generous. And it means, obviously, the wealthier are getting, a very pleasant...
tax break.
Tax-free opportunity. That is generous, and you know, I obviously there are some people who can afford to put the maximum amount in, and of course you don't have to put the maximum amount in, you can put any amount up to, and of course there's been a huge growth in stocks and shares ISAs. The cash ISAs have been, I think, numerically even larger, and I think it makes sense to actually trim the cash ISA.
Okay.
To encourage more people it's not a complete answer, but it will encourage them, I think, to think a little bit more about supporting UK companies by buying equities. And I think they've done it actually in quite a sensible and sensitive way in saying that the over 65s can still put the maximum amount into a cash ISA.
Yes, I believe so.
But it's been reduced, I think, to 12,000 for
under 65.
Those under 65, yes.
Okay, so you're quite happy about that aspect. I mean, you've mentioned it already. So back in the 80s, there was this iconic Tell Sid campaign, which was around privatisation. And,
yes.
For example, my grandma, she owned shares in British Gas and then Centrica, until the day she died, I think. I think in April, we've got this UK retail investment campaign launching. I mean, do you think that can have anything like the same impact?
I think and hope it will have an impact.
Mm.
Whether it will quite have the same, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Obviously the Tell Sid campaign involving, the sale of the British Telecom and British Gas and what have you, was very successful. But it's just a pity it was never really built upon and developed.
Yes.
And one of the questions I was asked, by the way, in quizzes if I'm involved, and if I'm talking to investment minded individuals, is to ask them if you'd put the same amount of money into all the government privatizations, which would have been the most successful investment?
That's interesting.
And no one, I have to tell you, Jeremy, no one's got it right. I don't know whether you would have.
I don't know.
Right.
So what's the answer?
And no one's got it right. And the answer is by a mile, Associated British Ports.
Oh, right.
By a mile. Because at that stage, when the ports were floated off as a privatized, we had the Dock Labour Scheme so that the ports were not over attractive commercially, and also most of the port companies had huge tracts of semi-derelict land, which over the years has been developed and built on, and of course the ports have become much more profitable and substantial.
Yes,
as trade has increased. So by a mile, the answer is Associated British Ports, but no one. No one has got that right.
Okay.
Anyway, spreading the word. And of course, they were then taken over, I think I'm right in saying, by Macquarie of Australia.
I see. Okay. Well, that's one I'll have to look up myself.
Right.
Another thing I wanted to ask was, there is a sense this topic is a bit of a silver bullet politically, because, on the one hand, you can encourage people to save more for retirement. But on the other, there's this idea that if we get more people investing, all this money will flow into the UK stock market and even assets like UK infrastructure. I mean, do you think that's realistic that there'll be this big boost to the UK economy from this?
Big boost, probably no. But
okay.
I mean, I think it's accepted that UK market relative to others, certainly relative to the US, is undervalued. Although we have seen, obviously, an uplift
in
the last couple of years, yes, and investors have benefited from that. But I still think there are huge opportunities in the UK market, and I'm solely invested and focused on the UK market, and primarily small cap stocks, rather than the large cap ones.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you next. Actually, I mean, perhaps when you began investing, that was, people had a natural, I mean, the phrase home bias didn't even exist. People invested in their home market, right? And, there's been quite a lot of change since then. People tend to invest globally more, and everyone has access to tracker funds, to index funds. I mean, for a new investor today, what do you think is a better prospect? UK smaller companies or just, play it safe and go
well,
for the tracker
funds? Obviously, it's easier if you invest in a tracker or similar. I don't believe that you will do as well financially as if you successfully select smaller, faster growing companies. And of course, apart from the financial advantage. You know, I've had a huge amount of pleasure and fun and interest from investing over the years. And, you know, I used to go to annual general meetings fairly regularly, keeping close touch with the companies that I'm invested in. And it's been a huge part of my life.
Yes.
Over probably, I don't know, 65 years of investing, something like that. And so, I do what I can to try and encourage more people to actually focus. And you only need, in my view, two things to be a successful investor. I mean, obviously you need some money, but leaving that to one side, I think that's pretty self-evident. There are only two things: common sense and patience.
Mm.
Only the only two. You don't need to be a sort of brilliant mathematician or similar. Common sense and patience. And patience is the most important. And patience is what most people sadly haven't got. And of course, the problem is today with instant access to prices on your phone or
yes.
your iPad or whatever it is, the temptation, if people see a profit there, well, you know, to press a button and take that profit. Whereas really, you make your money by getting into something good, growing company and staying with it.
Yes.
There's a rather crude old American adage which says, you make your money by sitting on your ass. In other words, you get into something good
yes.
and stay with it. You know, people don't make money by and large from jumping in and out of stocks, unless you're operating a hedge fund and you've got huge amounts of money.
Yes.
For your average investor to make money, you actually need to get into a good company and broad brush stay with it.
Yes.
And so I've been lucky in many over the years in getting into some very good growing companies. Companies increasing their dividends. Many have been taken over, and I would wish a number of them had remained independent. But nevertheless,
yes,
that's the way the corporate world has developed. So, I just think there are great opportunities, and it's very sad when you realize. I think it was Barclays who gone on record as working out that people are sitting on something like £430 billion worth of cash in banks, as it were,
and, yes.
and getting next to no interest. You've got some great companies where you can invest. And I'm talking about investing, and my investment is very much geared to established companies that by and large are profitable and are paying dividends and not overborrowed.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about investing in startups or hope and prayer stocks. And there are some people who do that very successfully. But I'm very much a conservative investor. So I avoid mining stocks and I avoid biotech stocks. And I avoid, by and large, contracting businesses because they always hit bad contracts at some stage.
Yes.
So I'm really quite conservative and have built up my ISA and my non-ISA over the years, brick by brick. Obviously, over the years, it has given me a degree of financial independence.
Yes. And you have written a book as well, haven't you, a couple of years ago? Yummy Yoga, A First Taste of Stock Market
Investment.
Yes. Which tries to put these principles.
Yes, there were two books. The first one was How to Make a Million Dash Slowly.
Yes.
Which had a tortoise on the front. And that yes. was about building up, your holdings over the years. And then more recently, 3 or 4 years ago, a book focused on young people, no absolute bright young people or absolute novices, called Yummy Yogurt, A First Taste of Stock Market Investment. And it's a very small book, only 30 pages, and it's told through a little story. And I think if someone reads it and just spends a couple of hours with it, they really will have a huge grasp of the basics of stock market investment.
Yes.
So I've tried to make it as small a book as possible and as easy a read as possible, told through a little story.
Okay. Well, that kind of brings me on to the last question I wanted to ask about this topic, John. And you mentioned cryptocurrencies earlier. There's some incredible FCA research that 8% of UK adults own crypto, and at one point it's been high as 12%. And You know, you only have to go on the tube in London, and there's investment for trading apps, cryptocurrency apps, everywhere, really. It does feel that something is going on in terms of people starting to, make at least some of these speculative investments. What hope do you think there is for capitalizing on that and converting some of those people into more conventional long-term investors?
Well, I think there's a huge opportunity.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, those who got into crypto very early on, you know, have made a fortune. You know, it's not for me. And I think, you know, a lot of people are probably going to get burnt at some stage. You know, some have just thought it was easy money.
Yes.
But there we are. It's not for me. And that's why, really, I'm all for encouraging people to invest sensibly and safely in good UK companies, which will benefit them longer term, and hopefully they can sleep at night as well. Whereas, you know, crypto tends to sort of bounce around, as it were.
Yes.
You know, cryptocurrency. Well, you might as well you know, bet on the horses or the greyhounds. Although I don't think too many greyhounds exist these days.
Yes.
Greyhound racing. So I think if we start educating our youngsters in schools about finance and investment, what a deposit is, what a bank, what a share is, and if the government campaign in the spring is successful, and I hope it is, we might, you know, gradually begin to become more of a share owning society.
Okay, I'd like to finish with a question, you know, more on the outlook for the UK market and your own portfolio. We mentioned that, you know, the FTSE 100 has actually been, you know, a strongly performing index in the last couple of years, you know, versus other global indices. But UK small caps, which you specialize in, remain a bit in the doldrums. So, yeah, what do you think might change that? And what company that you own are you most excited about at the moment?
Oh, well, that's
or is that a tough question to answer?
No, it's only a tough question to answer. Is I couldn't name what name
a single one
one, because there are, you know, I'm probably in 25, 30 different companies. In some cases, although I predominantly focus on small caps, you know, I do from time to time go into the larger ones. And so when one was able to buy M&G, for example, on a 10% yield, or Legal & General on a 9% yield, and Aviva on an 8 or 9, as one could, you know, these were wonderful buying opportunities. Anyone who'd got any awareness of historic dividends and yields should have appreciated what huge opportunities they were. And so M&G, you know, is one of my largest holdings, and has appreciated very significantly. So I first bought when it was yielding 10%, but the yield is now just less than 6.5%. So I've trimmed a little bit of that holding very recently. But, you know, I'm still in some of those stocks, which obviously, you know, they're large market capitalizations. So obviously, if you do need some cash, you can sell some quite quickly.
Yes.
But then I'm invested in a number of smaller stocks, which have been, over the last couple of years, been very successful.
Okay, not out of favor.
No. I mean, I've done very well on things like Concurrent Technologies, and Cerillion, who provide business services for the world telecom sector, Ampario in natural animal growth stimulants,
right,
and products, which had a great 20 years of dividend growth, mm-hmm, of dividend growth. Goodwins in the potteries, which I think is our greatest engineering business outside Rolls-Royce. It's been a wonderful investment over the years, and I think for me, I think has appreciated, you know, 5 or 6 times in the few years that I've had it. So these are great businesses, and there are a number of others as well that I'm in on attractive yields.
Yes.
Yields of 6.5%, 7%. These businesses, I think, have got futures. I think a number of them will be taken over, and I would actually prefer them probably to go on and grow. But the people who built some of them up obviously will want to capitalize on their on their life's work, and so they will be taken over, and this will provide normally a premium on prevailing prices and cash to reinvest. And of course, within my ISA, I'm reinvesting the very significant dividend flow there.
Yes.
Gradually building up, and some great dividend yields. Now you can get, 7% yield on things like, workspace, primary health properties, for example, which owns and helps modernize doctors' surgeries and pharmacies.
Yes.
Growing fast in Ireland. So the government effectively pays the rent. So it's a great business, and standing at a discount to assets and dividend yield of about 7%. So, there are wonderful opportunities out there. And
yes.
I just wish more people, became aware of them and seize these attractive situations.
Okay, well, John Lord Lee, that seems an excellent note to finish on. So, yeah, thanks very much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
But today is VE Day. The boys
the newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929. The Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.